Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Podcast One presents Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews, the ultimate insider's scoop on the best new books. Every week, Kirkus brings you author interviews, recommendations from the bestseller lists, and insights into books that are not yet on your radar.
Hi, I'm Clay Smith. I'm the editor of Kirkus Reviews.
And I'm Megan LaBrice, the editor at large.
And today, if you are a fan of NPR podcast, and particularly the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR, which is co-hosted by Linda Holmes, then you are in for a treat because we are talking to her about her first novel, which is titled Evie Drake Starts Over. And we call it a warm and lovely romance, perfect for readers of Rainbow Rowell and Louise Miller.
You know what I was catching off of this like slightly? I thought that fans of Maria Semple would really like this novel too.
Yeah, it kind of has that quirkiness.
Yeah, and that kind of like no BS. So, you know, like these are real characters, you know.
And that, yeah, and that feeling of that setting influences the quirkiness of the characters. So in Maria Semple's novel, it's Seattle and sort of, you know, left coast liberals and their quirks. And this one, it is small town Maine, which, of course, you know, viewers of TV and of pop culture for a while have known about quirky, you know, small town Maine. I mean, it's shown up in TV and other novels, but she really depicts this town, I guess, Calcasette, Maine, which she has made up in a kind of lovely way. But the novel is about a widow and a former baseball player who both are kind of stalled in life, grieving in their own ways. And of course, like happens in a sort of warm-hearted novel like this, they are thrown together and we are intrigued as the reader to see what happens, right?
They are thrown together, but you don't know if they're going to get together. So
yeah, she does keep you guessing on that front, which is really
keep
great.
Reading.
That's part of the suspense of the book, right?
Right.
So after this little break with a sponsored interview, why don't we call up Linda and see what she has to say?
Honestly, can't wait.
A.J. Wooden has had a three-decade career in human resources. In her memoir, Gardening with Guns, she recounts a series of life-changing secrets revealed after her father's suicide. Our reviewer calls it an engaging and carefully constructed account of trauma and starting over. In this sponsored interview, we talk with A.J. about her memoir. A.J., welcome to Fully Booked.
Thank you.
So this is your debut memoir, and it covers a lot. A father who kills himself, an abusive stepfather, a closeted gay husband. How did you manage to organize all of this material into a coherent whole?
You know, it's funny. From the moment I started really thinking seriously about the book, I had the notion of starting with my father's death and kind of going back in time and wrapping it all up with. Because that's kind of how it happened. You know, I felt it was when my father passed away that really had me looking introspectively at all these things and how they contributed.
Right. And it seemed like something that ran throughout the story was a theme of secrecy. And now in Gardening with Guns, you've revealed everything so publicly. How does that feel?
It actually feels it feels very neutral. I have to say I had a lot of anxiety about it when I was writing the book. Initially, I wasn't going to publish the book. And as I became more and more convinced that I needed to publish the book, that was very concerning for me. But now that it's done, I just feel very neutral about it. I'm not embarrassed. I'm not really happy or sad. It just feels very kind of like the slate's been completely cleaned.
Mm-hmm. And was there any one particular part that was a struggle for you?
Yeah, actually a lot of it. The you know, looking back in time, although I really had felt as though I had dealt with my stepfather, with my mother, with all of those things, I realized I had not. Mm-hmm. So there were lots of pauses in writing the book. I would start and then I would stop for months on end.
Right.
And I finally started to realize that that was not an accident.
Right.
So, you know, it just took some time to work through it.
Mm-hmm. And did you work with an editor on the project?
Only at the very end, and they were very kind of minimal edits. Most of the organization of the book and everything was really, it was more grammar editing, if you will. Mm-hmm. I didn't really have editing around the storyline itself. That was my own, obsessive focus on it.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of responses have you had to it?
Overall, it has been very positive, almost overwhelmingly so. Mm-hmm. It's it really kind of quite surprising because, you know, again, this book, the story has been inside of me for so long, and it took me almost 2 years to write it from when I really started thinking about doing it. So getting that sort of feedback is very gratifying. I've had a lot of people tell me that it should be a movie.
Well, AJ, thanks so much for talking with us about your book. If you're just joining the podcast, you can find Gardening with Guns at online retailers and by request at your local bookstore.
To me, it's such a musical novel. It's such a sonorous auditory novel, and it's such a listener's novel. And I have this theory I'm working on this morning. It's a listener's novel in more ways than one. I have a few bullet points. There's close attention paid to listening, the art of listening, not so much the science in the relationships between the characters. And I have examples if needed. Evie is a transcriber, which is like mostly a professional listener, you know, working with interview tapes from researchers and journalists and going through your Goodreads reviews, Linda, which if you haven't read them already, I strongly recommend that you do, which is something I have suggested to no author ever. I would write. This is the only time. But a lot of your early readers are your listeners from the podcast, and it's beautiful, the things they've said. They feel like this book is almost like the fulfillment of a promise to them.
Oh, well, that's wonderful. I'm so happy that they feel that way. And I share the hope that was shared with me by a friend recently that everyone who is excited to read the book has not already read it.
Mm. Oh, no. Many, many more enthusiasts to come, I can say.
Oh, I hope so.
Lots of listening going on in this novel. What if we just had an entire podcast, 30 minutes of just listening, the three of us, to one another? Wouldn't that be so great?
I'm up to it. I'm up to it.
But, I mean, Megan is right, Linda, that the dialogue in this novel, I mean, it really gets you right to the heart of the characters. It's almost reminded me... not quite, but a little bit of the Thin Man movies from the 30s, which I love.
Oh, heavens.
Yeah.
That's very flattering.
And we're just going to scoop out that praise today. We're just going to heap it all up in a big ice cream sundae of compliments. We got more for you.
Fabulous. Fabulous. Yeah, it's, you know, I love good dialogue. I listen to, and I love good kind of romantic comedy dialogue. I was a big Moonlighting fan when that was on. I have watched, you know, every Nora Ephron romantic comedy 400 times. It's definitely where my sweet spot is in terms of my own affection for movies and television. So, it means a lot to me that people have said, oh, hey, you know, this dialogue sounds good and it sounds rhythmic. Cause I think a lot of that is the lessons of those things. And, you know, Aaron Sorkin, who I don't love everything he's ever done, but I love the way he writes dialogue. So all of those influences are undoubtedly at play in this book.
Could you tell me a little bit more about how Sorkin does dialogue? Like what are the qualities you admire?
Yeah. So one of the ways that Sorkin does dialogue is that it loops in a way that, that's very rhythmic. So he'll say, I'll give you a quote from Sports Night, which is, probably the least seen of his TV shows, but my personal favorite. And, it has two characters talking about a difficult situation, and one of them says, it's a vicious circle. And I'm doing this from memory.
Okay.
And one of them says, it's a vicious circle. And the other one says, just keeps going round and round. And the other one says, that's what makes it vicious. And the first one says, and a circle. And So he just has this kind of looping circular. And I think everybody is familiar with the fact that his dialogue often repeats. And there's a moment in this book where they start talking about the concept of giving the go sign. And if you read that exchange, you'll sort of see a lot of Aaron Sorkin in it. They talk about what should be the go sign, and it goes back and forth in this very almost like tennis player kind of way.
Yeah.
And that's the place in the book that I look at and I think, well, Holmes, this is just you lifting directly from Aaron Sorkin. So I thank him for that.
Mm-hmm. I got another spot in the dialogue that I lifted. Get in touch with my inner Zulu warrior.
Oh, yeah.
You have to be kidding me. Nobody said Zulu warrior. Oh, hell yes, they did. They said inner Zulu warrior. They said inner Peyton Manning. Somebody said inner fucking Hannibal Lecter. Like, I'd want to find that if I had it. Yeah, I love that little spot of dialogue. But I just realized we have gotten so far ahead of ourselves that we haven't even named the characters who are talking. We haven't said what they're doing, and we haven't said where they are. So if you would, please, could you set this story up for our listeners?
Absolutely. Evie is a woman who lives in Midcoast, Maine. She's married to a doctor. She has what everybody considers to be a very good marriage. But she has decided to leave her husband. She's unhappy and she's just about to leave. And this is not a spoiler because that happens in the prologue to the book. She's just about to leave her husband when she learns that he's been in a car accident. She eventually learns that he's died. And so she is essentially cut off from her experience of leaving him, which she really felt like she needed to do to kind of be fully past that marriage. And so in a way, her natural processing of this unhappy marriage is interrupted because now she goes into this role of grieving, which because she hasn't really shared with people how unhappy the marriage was, she's not really able to explain to them what is on her mind after he's gone. So she's very kind of stuck in place by this experience. And then her best friend is a guy who's a single dad, whose name is Andy, and he is dear friends. His dear childhood friend is this guy whose name is Dean, who has been a pitcher for the Yankees and was a very, very good pitcher for the Yankees, and then developed a case of the yips. And if you've ever seen somebody who has the yips, it's absolutely bizarre and terrifying. They do things like a second baseman who's been a professional baseball player for many years will just start throwing into the stands when they try to throw to first. It's really weird. It is a real phenomenon that has ended a lot of careers. And Dean has suffered from this, tried to resolve it, and eventually decided to leave baseball. So he is also kind of careening around a little bit, stuck in place. And Andy says, come up here, come to Maine, get some quiet. And he suggests that Dean rent the apartment that's attached to the back of Evie's house. Because, you know, everybody has the, in certain places, everybody's got the in-law suite or the rental suite or the in-law.
Right.
And she has one of those as well. So she rents it to Dean because he's a friend of a friend. And they become close. And at the same time, she's kind of, you know, managing the fallout from the end of her marriage. So that's kind of where these people find themselves.
So, Linda, I mean, Evie and Dean are, you know, really fully realized and vivid. Can you take us back a little bit to how those characters first came to you?
Yeah, you know, Evie came to me as a very specific image, which was a woman at a funeral of someone that she was not sorry to be without. And I, you know, sometimes I think when you're thinking about fiction, you get a very specific image and the entire story really grows from that image. And it actually does come up in the book. It's an image of someone grabbing her on the elbow and kind of trying to comfort her at this little memorial service. It's not his funeral, but it's a later memorial. Someone kind of grabbing her by the elbow to comfort her. And her just suddenly being very aware that she doesn't really want this kind of comfort. And out of that grew this idea of what it feels like to be socially, in a way, socially grieving, but not really grieving, not personally grieving. And of course, she feels a lot of guilt about that because she feels bad for the people like his family who did love him and do miss him. And none of them really know that she was in the process of leaving. And Dean really, you know, I think if you're a writer, you have a natural tendency to sympathize with the idea of the Yips because, just as a baseball player might wake up and think, you know, what if I never am able to throw straight again? I think writers often think, what if I just wake up one day and I just never have another good idea? So I think I'm very, drawn to that. And also the thing about the Yips is it's just weird. It's just a weird phenomenon that is still not entirely understood. It is the true story, which is in the book, of Chuck Knoblauch, who was a second baseman for the Yankees, throwing into the stands and out of everybody who was there, managing to hit Keith Olbermann's mother with the baseball. That's a true story.
And I wondered about that.
It is shocking that a thing like that would really happen, because it really does make you feel like somebody's long bony finger has come down and just pointed at the guy. And I think for me, so they started off as kind of these two very separate stories, and it was two people who are kind of both feeling kind of broken and feeling like the plans that they had for themselves had been abruptly upended. And originally they existed in kind of two different book ideas, but then it occurred to me that if you put them in the same place, that those stories might kind of be in dialogue with each other a little bit.
Yeah, and the place you put them is, of course, Calicasset, Maine. It's a mid-coast town. That does not exist. You invented a whole town.
I did. Now, I stole a lot of things about it from real towns that really exist. That is that part of Maine, which is essentially the area around kind of Rockland and Camden. It's about an hour. It's probably about an hour north of Portland. Is a really charming and wonderful part of Maine where my family used to go on vacation. So there are a lot of things in the book in that town that are borrowed from real towns. But yeah, the town does not exist. That is a fictional town.
Did you visit Maine in the summer and the winter, Linda? Because I asked because I like the way you sort of set the scene in a very brief way by saying there was just half an inch that day. It was windy that day. It's just like you instantly get the sense of Maine weather just in a very brief sort of blip by you.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever actually been there in the middle of winter, but I've been there in November. And so you start to get the feel. They do have pretty brutal winters. It's right on the water and it's pretty far north, and they do have brutal winters. And I did a lot of reading as well, about that area, and particularly about lobster fishing up there and things like that. So, yeah, I think I got that from a combination of sources, but I have been up there. I have been up there in late fall.
The very, very best detail of this town to me is the cereal box races. Was that all you, or
can you set this up, Megan? Because this is pretty, or Linda, this is pretty priceless.
So the cereal box race story, I'll tell you two things about it. First, I'll explain what it does in the book, and then I'll explain where it comes from in real life.
Great.
In the book, the cereal box races, that's a story that Evie tells Dean when they're kind of first becoming friends. And it's a story about the local minor league baseball team, which is called the Calicasset Claws, has a between innings activity for the kids in town where they all put on cereal box costumes. There's a Cheerios box and a Wheaties box and a Chex box, and then they race around the bases. If you know minor league baseball, you know that things like this absolutely happen. Yes. Sausage races, you know, and even in the major leagues, the presidents at the Washington Nationals games, you have a bunch of things like this that really happen. But especially in minor league baseball, there's a lot of this kind of stuff. But also in Rockland, Maine, which is where my family vacations were, they have something called the lobster crate races. And the lobster crate races involve a string of lobster crates going out into the water. So this is just on the shore. This is not the baseball park, but a bunch of lobster crates that are strung together, floating out into the water. And then you have to run across them, and you run as far as you can across as many crates as possible before you fall in the water. And I wrote the cereal box races story separate from writing this novel. I wrote it as a little piece of flash fiction in probably 2006 or seven. And it just sat on the computer and in my files. And I think I posted it to a personal blog, I think. And then when I got to writing this story, I thought, you know, I want her to be able to explain this town to him. And I want her to be able to explain her love of where she lives and also kind of make it fun and give her some personality in how she tells the story. So I had this little bit of flash fiction sitting around, which I utilized for that purpose.
It is the least uplifting thing that has ever brought a town together, she tells Dean. It is the opposite of the end of a Hallmark Channel movie.
Well, that's right, because of course the cereal box racist story that's in the book also happens at the end of a town scandal, essentially. So it's kind of become this local, you know, local thing where everybody's gotten all bent out of shape about which kid is going to win the cereal box races. So yes, it's becomes a very un-uplifting thing that everybody gets all wound up about, as sometimes happens in large and small towns.
Indeed.
So Linda, what do you think really brings Dean and Evie together? I mean, they both are kind of stalled in their lives. You know, Dean is suffering from the yips and Evie is supposed to be grieving. The whole town thinks she should be grieving, but she knows a different story. What is it that is the sort of connection between them, do you think?
Well, I think in most cases, people become fast friends in part because they have a lot of ideas about the world in common. And I think Dean and Evie share a lot of ideas about what is important and what isn't important, which I think come out in some of those conversations about silly things like cereal box races. Mm-hmm. I also think that they have very compatible senses of humor. And I think that as sometimes happens in real relationships between real people, there are also ways in which the draw them to each other are things that they also later have to learn to manage. Like he is somewhat drawn to the fact that she is sad and he has some kind of compulsion to want to make her laugh, cheer her up. And she certainly has a kind of a fixer mentality. And so to her, I think the idea that he is sort of hurting and has this mysterious ailment is something that's very attractive to her. And I think there are a lot of people, especially but not exclusively women, I think there are a lot of people for whom, you know, it's hard to resist somebody who you think maybe just really, really needs something, really needs, needs something unspoken that maybe you can provide for them. And I think because she's been in this unhappy marriage and because she's been in this difficult, painful situation, she sees an opportunity where, you know, maybe this is somebody who I can help.
Yeah. And meanwhile, they both have, you know, like they both have the endorsement of Andy. Dean is Andy's childhood friend. And Andy is like Evie's platonic soulmate. Is that the phrase in the book? Yeah. Like, and I was really loving seeing a depiction of a genuine platonic hetero friendship. Like,
yeah,
you know, there's the whole Harry Sally conundrum. Can straight men and women be just friends?
Yeah. And it's so silly. I mean, I think most people have those friendships in their life and yet somehow they get drawn into those conversations anyway. I think some people would tell you, well, yes, I have them, but I have them because I'm married and the other person's married and we know each other from work. So that doesn't count. But the thing is people, even people who are single or one of them single or whatever, you know, you can be friends with anyone. And that was definitely something my best friend is a man and a single dad as Andy is. And it was definitely something that I thought like, I would enjoy writing this kind of friendship, which I agree. I just don't see very often. Very often in stories like this, the best friend will be either a single woman who has a lot of complaints about her own dating life, or it will be a gay best friend. Right. And I love a gay best friend. I love a single best friend. I have many friends of many, you know, descriptions, but I hadn't seen a lot of close platonic friendships between straight men and straight women. And I really, really wanted to explore that in the book.
So Linda, I mean, on the podcast that you host, you all are, you know, discussing culture and sometimes ripping culture to shreds. is it hard to create knowing the critical infrastructure that exists and how critical people can be?
I mean, it is, but at the same time, you know, one of the great myths is that if you're a critic, you haven't experienced, you know, the kind of criticism that you dish out. But, mm-hmm. you know, I've been a woman writer on the internet since 2001.
Yeah. Bless.
And I have been called, probably everything that you can think of that you would call somebody. And I have had many, many people tell me I'm unqualified to do my job. I've had many, many people tell me I'm an embarrassment to NPR. Like I've been through many, many rounds of people being critical of the work that I do as a commentator, as a mm-hmm. writer and a critic. So I think I'm probably somewhat more prepared than a lot of people are for what it's like to have people hate the book. But at the same time, it's terrible having people hate the book. I mean, it's been less that there are the stuff that's kind of filtered down to me is less people who really hate the book and more people who, you know, they'll say something like, there's one, I saw one thing that was like, I just thought it would be more interesting. And I just sort of was like, I thought about making it more interesting, but then I decided,
this is just enough.
This is just interesting. It's interesting enough. I don't want to make it too interesting.
If you want a novel that's really interesting, you got to pay $5 more.
Like, this is this novel. My next one is going to be really interesting.
You see, this is, again, why you have to read your Goodreads reviews, because they are review after review after review, pure sunshine. So
that's lovely. And people have been very generous. And I think it is a kind of a book that attracts more, more kindness than criticism, because it's not, you know, I think it's the kind of book where people find it relatively easy to just leave it alone if it's not their thing. So people have overwhelmingly been really kind about it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if you don't like joy or fun or hilarious, snappy dialogue, in fact, I'd like to just take this into a new segment that I'm going to call Pure Appreciation. Here are three things I pulled that just made me laugh out loud. This is of Evie. She could imagine how elated a photographer must have been to take Dean out for a shoot and find a boat called the Second Chance for him to sit on. It might as well have been called the floating blunt force metaphor. Okay. Dean has an ex-girlfriend, Melanie Copps, who has, quote, her eyebrows. Evie's looking at a picture of her. And this woman has these eyebrows that looked like she won them playing poker with Audrey Hepburn's ghost. And then on the very next page, Evie's preparing for a date with Dean. And she put 3 drops of an eye serum under each eye because eye skin was apparently not made of regular skin. And, you know, as a woman to whom eye serums are marketed. That is so a thing. Thank you for calling it out.
It's funny. That was a really fun kind of sequence for me to write. Cause I intentionally, like, the book actually does not include a lot of physical description of her because I didn't think it was all that important. And so it doesn't so much have, you know, she looks like this, she has this kind of body and these kind of hips or whatever. But it has that sequence where she's getting ready for this night out and she spends a lot of time kind of examining her own looks. So you don't necessarily get an objective view of here's what she looks like, here's what her looks are like. But I wanted to have some indication of what her relationship with her looks is, if that makes sense. So it's less important that you know what she looks like and more important that you know how it feels to her to be kind of going through this process after being married to the first guy she ever really had a serious relationship with. And this is kind of only the second person she's really made any effort with. What it's like for her in her mid-30s to kind of go through that experience of preparing to kind of present herself to somebody for the first time, really, as an adult.
Yeah.
Well, the novel is Evie Drake Starts Over. It's by Linda Holmes. It's out now. And Linda, thanks so much for taking some time to talk to us.
Oh, thank you so much for doing this. I appreciate it.
We didn't get to talk about this, Megan, but there was an added pleasure to this novel for me, which is that I'm reading it in Austin, Texas, the week that it's going to be 102 degrees this week. And the novel is partially set in Maine in winter. And the snow and the wind and the rain just made me feel so wonderful.
She really does make the setting, oh, God, like, really, Clay. I really like this book. I really love this book.
Well, it's very warm. Its heart is very warm and... it just sort of gathers you in, you know, into a cabin in Maine in the winter.
Yeah, and it satisfies on every level. So I highly recommended this.
And it's her first.
Summer. Yeah. Oh, so, that always
it's impressive.
Makes me really excited too for the author. Like, what an amazing time in somebody's life, you know? And I'm really glad that she came on and shared a little bit more about it with us.
So after the break, why don't we call up our senior editors to see which new books that are out this week they think you ought to be paying attention to.
Let's do it.
You're listening to Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. The ultimate insider scoop on the latest books right here on Fully Booked.
Welcome back. We've got our senior editors, except for our nonfiction editor, Eric Liebetrau. So with us are Vicky Smith, who covers children's books for us. Laura Simeon is our young adult book editor. And Laurie Muchnick is our fiction editor. So Vicky, tell us, what is your favorite book in children's world this week?
It is How to Read a Book by Kwame Alexander with illustrations by Melissa Sweet. And I'm not usually a big fan of the books are awesome types of books because I sort of feel like just read a book instead of reading a book about a book. But for every rule, there is an exception, and this is one of them. And it's not really a yay, reading is awesome type of book anyway, but it's a poem that really makes reading this incredibly sensory, immersive experience. Alexander writes, "First, find a tree. A black tupelo or dawn redwood will do, and plant yourself. It's okay if you prefer a stoop, like Langston Hughes. Once you're comfy, peel its gentle skin like you would a clementine, the color of sunrise, the scent of morning air and sweet butterfly kisses. Next, dig your thumb at the bottom of each juicy section and pop the words out." So the words are these incredibly evocative, and Melissa Sweet, who is one of the best conceptual illustrators there is today, she has really outdone herself with these collages. She uses pages from actual books, these great big daubs of color. You can see that they're sort of layered one on top of another, cutouts of old fancy display type. It's just everything about it says books are awesome, but it never says books are awesome, which makes it a completely successful book about a book.
I have to disagree with you, Vicky, for one time ever. I love books about books. Books are awesome. This one, looking at this, it reminded me of one of my favorite books, which is Max's Words by Kate Banks.
It is a nice one.
Yeah. It's not about how books are awesome, but how words are awesome, which I guess is very close, right?
And we did a book on the podcast a few weeks ago about how words are awesome. We had Amanda Montell, debut writer, talking about her book, Word Slut, and the fascinations of being a linguist, you know?
That's true. That's true. Max's Words is a picture book about a boy whose brother's collect coins and stamps. So he decides to collect words, you know, so it's really just about words. And of course, if you collect a lot of coins or stamps, you just have a lot of coins or stamps. But when you collect a lot of words, you get a story. So maybe Vicky would find that a little didactic, but I don't know. I kind of love it.
I don't find that. That is another exception. And okay. I love Boris Kulikov's illustrations for that book are all wonderful. I think that the distinction is between the books that say, go to the library and pick out a book. You can go anywhere. It's a book. they're almost always in really lockstep rhyme. And it's just sort of this list of awesome stuff that you can read about, but it never actually gives you anything awesome to read about. To me, a meditation on the, you know, sort of amazing things you can do with words is a little bit different.
Okay.
I'm so here for this. Okay. you heard it first. The recommendation is How to Read a Book by Kwame Alexander, illustrated by Melissa Sweet. Turning now to YA. Laura, what's your choice for us?
So my choice for this week is Wicked Fox. It's a debut novel by Kat Cho, and it's set in present-day Seoul, South Korea, and it's about a girl called Myung, and she's a teenage gumiho, and a gumiho is a nine-tailed fox from Korean folklore, and they're kind of these shape-shifting characters, and to live, they absorb the gi, or like the life spirit, from people. So basically they kill people. However, Myung is a gumiho with a conscience, and she doesn't want people to suffer unnecessarily. So she only kills murderers because it's, you know, justice. And yes, she kills them humanely. So during full moon. But
what a relief.
Exactly. It changes everything. She and her mother have to move a lot to avoid suspicion, you know, because people are dying. And she ends up going to this new high school, and she has this classmate, Ji-hoon, and one night he's out walking his dog, and he's attacked by a goblin. So Myung, you know, rushes in to rescue him, and in the process, she loses her fox bead, which is, it's sort of like her soul, like the source of gumiho knowledge and power. And Ji-hoon accidentally touches it, so now they're kind of linked. They have this bond, and she confides in him. You know, he's the first person who knows the truth about her, and they're drawn into this battle, and there's romance. So I would say it's fun for generally people who enjoy fantasy, but also people who like K-drama will really appreciate it. And it's this fun kind of juxtaposition between things like regular teenage things like sneaking into homeroom late, and then, you know, epic battles against evil. So,
you know, Laura, as you talk about this book, it reminds me of one that's a little bit lighter-hearted, judging by your description, but it is equally fabulous, and it has that sort of combination of, you know, sort of the world is at stakes, and schoolwork, and that's The Epic Crush of Jeannie Lowe by F.C. Yee.
I was hoping you'd say that. Yes.
Well, and you know what, Megan?
Yeah.
There's a new one coming out in January.
Yeah, I just got it. Yes, I was all excited.
Oh, I am ridiculously excited.
I need it.
So read The Kat Cho while you're waiting for the Iron Will of Jeannie Lowe.
It's on.
I second that. Yeah.
So Laura's choice is Wicked Fox by Kat Cho. Laurie, what do you have going on in fiction?
I would like to recommend Mostly Dead Things by Kristen Arnett. This is another one of those books that I was so surprised and happy to see on the bestseller list, because it's a first novel from a small press, Tin House Books. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you look at it and you think, why this book? Why is it on the bestseller list? I'm happy it's there, you know, but I don't know what happened to make it be there. Mm-hmm. But it's one of these books like Lauren Groff's Florida, Book of Short Stories, that it's about Florida and all the strange things that go on there. It's about a young woman whose family has a taxidermy shop, and she has to take the reins and take over the taxidermy shop after her father commits suicide. And, you know, it kind of goes back and forth in time and shows her, the main character's name is Jessa, and it shows her learning taxidermy from her father, and, you know, long descriptions of slicing pelts off animals. And it's, you know, it's weird and interesting. And then after her father dies, her mother kind of flips out a little bit. She starts placing stuffed and mounted animals in the shop window in all kinds of sexual poses and creating these weird, you know, tableaus. Her brother starts just kind of sleeping through his shifts at work. He works at the car dealership. Jessa happens to be sort of in love with her brother's wife. Well, her brother's wife was her first love. I'm not sure if she's still in love with her now that I think about it. But so there's just a lot going on in this family, and there's, you know, this kind of weird, creepy Florida backdrop. It's really interesting and perceptive and off, you know, kind of an off-kilter book, a fun reading experience.
Laurie, I was curious, would you say this is a book that would mostly appeal to people who like character-driven stories? Would you say that's the primary audience?
I think there's a lot of plot going on also. Mm-hmm. So characters are interesting, but there's also plot. So
thanks.
Sure.
Well, thank you all for those great choices. We hope you join us next week. We're going to be talking to Lauren Meckling. She used to be a young adult book writer, and she's got her adult fiction debut with a novel titled How Could She? We gave it a starred review, and we call it a sharp dissection of the fraught dynamics of 30-something female friendship. So join us then. Until then, though, you know what to do. Turn this thing off and go read a book.
Thanks for listening to Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Check out new episodes every Tuesday at podcastone.com, on the Podcast One app, or you can subscribe on iTunes.